Disc 11.
Only if the federal government could deal directly with its citizens and not fear obstruction from the states could it be a true government. In number 17, Hamilton disagreed that national officials would be able to impose their wills on the states. State governments would always have superior claims on people's affections, and abuses of power would therefore more likely occur on the local level. Here, Hamilton had planned a tour d'horizon of ancient and modern confederacies, showing how they tended to fall apart. When he learned that Madison had already undertaken this work, Hamilton handed him his notes for Federalist numbers 18 through 20. The resulting, somewhat pedantic essays by Madison ended on a defensive note. I make no apology for having dwelt so long on the contemplation of these federal precedents. Experience is the oracle of truth, and where its responses are unequivocal, they ought to be conclusive and sacred. To round out his searching critique of the Articles of Confederation, Hamilton devoted two more essays to the central government's impotence in enforcing the law. Recalling Shays' rebellion, he inquired, "Who can determine what might have been the issue of Massachusetts' late convulsions if the malcontents had been headed by a Caesar or a Cromwell?" This and numerous other pejorative references to Caesar belie Jefferson's canard that Hamilton revered the Roman dictator. He endorsed the need for federal regulation of commerce and allayed fears that the central government would levy oppressive customs fees. If duties are too high, they lessen the consumption. The collection is eluded, and the product to the treasury is not so great as when they are confined within proper and moderate bounds. He also decried the Confederation's lack of a federal judiciary. Laws are a dead letter without courts to expound and define their true meaning and operation. In typically categorical fashion, Hamilton ended by dismissing the Articles of Confederation as an abomination, one of the most execrable forms of government that human infatuation ever contrived. In the next 14 numbers, 23 through 36, Hamilton undertook a point-by-point defense of the Constitution, making the case that an energetic government would require peacetime armies and taxation, both associated with British rule and hence anathema to radical populists. The new country would be so large, he contended, that only a mighty central government could govern it. To gain the requisite strength, that government would need the option of raising armies instead of relying on the much romanticized state militias. War, like most other things, is a science to be acquired and perfected by diligence, by perseverance, by time, and by practice. While others maintained that a wide ocean insulated America from European threats, Hamilton saw a country enmeshed in a shrinking world. The improvements in the art of navigation have rendered distant nations in a great measure neighbors. Economic and military strength went hand in hand. If we mean to be a commercial people, we must endeavor as soon as possible to have a navy. As to fears that the federal government would amass excessive power, Hamilton again reassured readers that the general government will at all times stand ready to check the usurpations of the state governments, and these will have the same disposition towards the general government. Similarly, state militias would check potential abuses of any national army, safeguarding the balance of power between the federal and state governments. Approaching the knotty subject of revenues in number 30, Hamilton described the power of taxation as an indispensable ingredient in every constitution. Without it, the Confederation government has gradually dwindled into a state of decay, approaching nearly to annihilation. Not only would taxes underwrite operating expenses, but they would enable the country to pay off its debt, restore its credit, and raise large loans in wartime. From his reading of history, Hamilton concluded a few essays later that war was an inescapable fact of life. The fiery and destructive passions of war reign in the human breast with much more powerful sway than the mild and beneficent sentiments of peace. Broaching the vital doctrine of implied powers in numbers 30 through 34, Hamilton asserted that in politics, the means ought to be proportioned to the end. There ought to be no limitation of a power destined to effect a purpose. He wanted the Constitution to be a flexible document. There ought to be a capacity to provide for future contingencies. Making another critical distinction, Hamilton denied that the federal government would retain an exclusive taxing power. States would have concurrent power to tax their citizens because the Constitution aims only at a partial union or consolidation. The sole exception would be the federal monopoly of customs duties, then the principal source of revenue and the leading source of existing tensions and inequities among the states. At moments, it seems clear that while scribbling the Federalist, Hamilton was daydreaming about becoming Treasury Secretary. In number 35, he wrote, "There is no part of the administration of government that requires extensive information and a thorough knowledge of the principles of political economy so much as the business of taxation." In the following essay, he inserted a statement with a patently autobiographical ring. "There are strong minds in every walk of life that will rise superior to the disadvantages of situation and will command the tribute due to their merit, not only from the classes to which they particularly belong, but from the society in general. The door ought to be equally open to all." At the same time, Hamilton thought that a Congress composed mostly of landowners, merchants, and professionals could legislate effectively for the masses. On January 11, 1788, Madison began to cover the general structure of the new union in a string of 20 essays, starting with number 37. Hamilton, now back in Albany, may have pitched in on the final 10. Until this point, Hamilton had scarcely said anything in the Federalist that he had not said repeatedly since his earliest wartime letters or in his Continentalist essays. Only as he touched upon such topics as elections in the later essays did he diverge from his own preferred beliefs, and even then he surrounded new positions with old arguments. Those who criticize Hamilton for having engaged in a propaganda exercise in the Federalist must reckon with the tremendous continuity that connects the Federalist essays to both his earlier and later writings. As Madison reviewed the compound character of the Federalist system in number 37, subtle but fateful differences with Hamilton began to emerge, differences that were to be enlarged over time. In number 41, Madison expressed reservations about standing armies and the onerous taxes needed to sustain them, and was cynical about the corruption of the British Parliament. In other places, however, he sounded like even more of a raging Anglophile than Hamilton. Madison faulted the Articles of Confederation for their vague language and savored the Constitution's precision, which he hoped would circumscribe federal powers. Hamilton, in contrast, capitalized on what he saw as the document's general and elastic language to expand government power. By numbers 59 through 61, Hamilton, returned to New York from Albany, took up the subject of congressional elections and regulations. Though identified with northern mercantile interests, Hamilton emphasized that in an agricultural society, the cultivators of land must, upon the whole, preponderate in the government. In Federalist No. 60, he offered a vision of a House of Representatives dominated by landholders, but also marked by diversity. Hamilton was careful to stress that for the foreseeable future, manufacturing would play an auxiliary role in a predominantly agricultural society. The five essays, 62 through 66, on the Senate embody the Federalists' most collaborative section, with Madison handling the first two, Jay reappearing to take number 64, and Hamilton winding up the two concluding numbers. In number 62, Madison stated frankly that the balance struck between proportional representation in the House and equal representation in the Senate had come from political compromise, not ideal theory. In the next essay, he defended the small, elite Senate against charges that it would grow into a tyrannical aristocracy, and sounded Hamiltonian when he stated that liberty may be endangered by the abuses of liberty as well as by the abuses of power. The former rather than the latter is apparently most to be apprehended by the United States. With this parting shot, Madison went back to Virginia in March to defend the Constitution in his home state. Once Jay wrote number 64 on the treaty powers of the Senate, Hamilton single-handedly penned the next 21 essays, 65 through 85, handling parts of the Senate as well as the entire commentary on the executive and judicial branches. In his superb account of Senate impeachment powers in number 65, Hamilton visualized with exceptional prescience the problems that would occur when passions inflamed the country and partisanship split the Senate over an accused federal official. Since the impeached president or federal judge would remain liable to prosecution if removed from office, Hamilton showed the Constitution's wisdom in having the Chief Justice alone preside over the trial instead of the entire Supreme Court. The Senate would benefit from the Chief Justice's judicial knowledge while keeping the High Court free for any future decisions related to the case. Acknowledging imperfections in the impeachment process, Hamilton stressed that the Constitution had produced the best compromise available. If mankind were to resolve to agree in no institution of government until every part of it had been adjusted to the most exact standard of perfection, society would soon become a general scene of anarchy and the world a desert. In turning to the executive branch, numbers 67 through 77, Hamilton wrote about the part of government in which he had the keenest interest and which he considered the engine of the entire machinery. As he phrased it in number 70, energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government. He mocked exaggerated fears of the powers bestowed on the president and said that in some respects he would have fewer powers than New York's governor. Hamilton drew freely on statements he made at the Constitutional Convention to distinguish his elective monarch from a king. The British king, he pointed out, was hereditary, could not be removed by impeachment, had an absolute veto over the laws of both houses, could dissolve Parliament, declare war, make treaties, confer titles of nobility, and bestow church offices. It clearly exasperated Hamilton that critics were drawing facile comparisons between the American president and the British king. In his essays on the need for executive branch vigor, Hamilton continually invoked the King of England as an example of what should be avoided, especially the monarch's lack of accountability. Every president ought to be personally responsible for his behavior in office. In number 71, Hamilton presented his theory of presidents as leaders who should act for the popular good, even if the people were sometimes deluded about their interests. Hamilton made the argument that the separate branches of government were not intended only to curb one another, but to afford independence to one another. To what purpose separate the executive or the judiciary from the legislative if both the executive and the judiciary are so constituted as to be at the absolute devotion of the legislative? Deviating from his convention speech, Hamilton now touted the merits of a 4-year term for the president, who could run for additional terms. This would give occupants of the office an incentive to perform well and secure to the government the advantage of permanency in a wise system of administration. In reviewing presidential powers, 73 through 77, Hamilton praised the presidential veto as a way to contain the legislature and offset popular fads. Where populists worried that the executive branch might overwhelm the legislature, Hamilton had a contrary fear of excessive legislative power. In number 74, he made a moving appeal for the presidential power to issue pardons. Humanity and good policy conspire to dictate that the benign prerogative for pardoning should be as little as possible fettered or embarrassed. The criminal code of every country partakes so much of necessary severity that without an easy access to exceptions in favor of unfortunate guilt, justice would wear a countenance too sanguinary and cruel. In this passage, he sounded reminiscent of the young Colonel Hamilton who pleaded with General Washington to show mercy for Major John André. Notwithstanding his preference for a strong president, Hamilton applauded many checks on presidential power. To protect the country from a president corrupted by foreign ministries, Hamilton approved the provision requiring presidents to obtain 2/3 approval of the Senate to enact treaties. In a similar vein, he approved the presidential power to appoint ambassadors and Supreme Court judges, subject to Senate confirmation, which would check a spirit of favoritism in the president. In the Federalist Papers, Hamilton was as quick to applaud checks on powers as those powers themselves, as he continued his lifelong effort to balance freedom and order. In the final analysis, he thought that the federal government, not the states, would be the best guarantee of individual liberty. In the last eight essays of The Federalist, 78 through 85, written for the conclusion of the second bound volume, Hamilton dedicated the first six to the judiciary. Throughout his career, he showed special solicitude for an independent judiciary, which he thought the most important guardian of minority rights, but also the weakest of the three branches of government. It commands neither the press nor the sword. It has scarcely any patronage. He was especially intent that the federal judiciary check any legislative abuses. In number 78, Hamilton introduced an essential concept, never made explicit in the Constitution, that the Supreme Court should be able to review and overturn legislation as unconstitutional. At Philadelphia, delegates had concentrated on the question of state versus federal courts, not whether courts could invalidate legislation. Here, Hamilton bluntly affirmed that no legislative act contrary to the Constitution can be valid, laying the intellectual groundwork for the doctrine of judicial review later promulgated by Supreme Court Justice John Marshall. When Hamilton wrote these words, state judges had taken only the first tentative steps in nullifying laws passed by their assemblies. Hamilton revered great judges and in the next essay pondered how the most highly qualified people could be recruited and retained by the courts. He argued for adequate salaries and against both age limits and the power to remove judges, except by impeachment. He then outlined the scope of the court's jurisdiction and the separate bailiwicks of the Supreme Court and the appellate courts. In number 82, Hamilton tackled the vexed issue of how powers would be divided between state and federal courts, insisting that, in the last analysis, judicial power must rest with the federal courts. Though a believer in trial by jury, he dissented from the fanciful idea that juries were universally applicable in civil as well as criminal cases. He was particularly alarmed at the prospect that juries would sit in cases involving foreign relations, where their ignorance of the law of nations might afford occasions of reprisal and war from the countries affected. Many foes of the Constitution were demanding a Bill of Rights as a precondition for ratification. In number 84, Hamilton said this would be superfluous and even potentially hazardous. For why declare that things shall not be done which there is no power to do? Why, for instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press shall not be restrained when no power is given by which restrictions may be imposed? He also thought the Constitution had already guaranteed many rights ranging from habeas corpus to trial by jury. Where Hamilton often seems oracular in The Federalist, he was frightfully wide of the mark when it came to a Bill of Rights, one of his real failures of vision. We should note that in Federalist number 84, he supported with enthusiasm the Constitution's ban on titles of nobility. This may truly be denominated the cornerstone of Republican government, for so long as they are excluded, there can never be serious danger that the government will be any other than that of the people. In the final essay, number 85, Hamilton reminded readers that the Constitution was not a perfect document, and cited Hume that only time and experience could guide political enterprises to completion. It would be folly to imagine that the framers could attain instant perfection. The final lines of The Federalist throbbed with high hopes, but were also tinged with darkness. On a promising note, Hamilton said, "A nation without a national government is, in my view, an awful spectacle. The establishment of a constitution in a time of profound peace by the voluntary consent of a whole people is a prodigy, to the completion of which I look forward with trembling anxiety." If Hamilton had ended on this uplifting note, he would not have been Hamilton. So he closed instead with the ominous warning that "I know that powerful individuals in this and in other states are enemies to a general national government in every possible shape." Thus ended the most persuasive defense of the Constitution ever written. By the year 2000, it had been quoted no fewer than 291 times in Supreme Court opinions, with the frequency of citations rising with the years. As the excruciating demands of the Federalist rendered Hamilton's life even more sedentary than usual, he was a prisoner of his desk. He had no relief from his labors or time for diversion. Re-elected to Congress by the New York legislature on January 22, 1788, he did not even have a chance to present his credentials until February 25th. That spring, swept up in a political whirlwind, he apologized to Governor Morris for having been incommunicado, saying, "The truth is that I have been so overwhelmed in avocations of one kind or another that I have scarcely had a moment to spare to a friend." Amid his manifold labors, Hamilton kept a careful eye on the pregnant Eliza, who gave birth to their fourth child, James Alexander, on April 14th. Eliza spent the summer with her family in Albany, attended by an unexpected visitor, Anne Venton Mitchell. The Federalist is so renowned as the foremost exposition of the Constitution that it is easy to forget its original aim: ratification in Hamilton's home state. Printed in only a dozen papers outside of New York, its larger influence was spotty. In places where it did appear, the verbal avalanche of Hamilton, Madison, and Jay overwhelmed hapless readers. In mid-December, one embattled anti-Federalist in Philadelphia bewailed the never-ending onslaught of words. "Publius has already written 26 numbers, as much as would jade the brains of any poor sinner, so that in decency he should now rest on his arms and let the people draw their breath for a little." Another anti-Federalist complained that Publius had endeavored to force conviction by a torrent of misplaced words. Supporters, however, had a bottomless appetite for the essays, and the authors' names began to leak out. When Edward Carrington of Virginia sent the first bound volume to Jefferson in Paris, he added with suspiciously precise guesswork, "They are written, it is supposed, by Messrs. Madison, Jay, and Hamilton." The Philadelphia Convention had decided that the Constitution would take effect once it was ratified by 9 state conventions. Hamilton had given the rationale for state conventions in Federalist No. 22. "The fabric of American empire ought to rest on the solid basis of the consent of the people." Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey approved the document in December 1787, Georgia and Connecticut in January, and Massachusetts by a slim majority in early February. The Federalist produced its greatest impact in the later stages of the ratification battle, especially after the first bound volume appeared on March 22nd. When New York selected convention delegates that April, Hamilton was among them. James Kent recalled that at one nomination meeting, the volumes were there circulated to the best of our judgments. Colonel Hamilton was very soon and very generally understood to be the sole or principal author. Madison sent hundreds of copies to Virginia delegates, including John Marshall. The Federalists' influence was to be especially critical in New York and Virginia, two large states indispensable to the Union's long-term viability. The state conventions were cunningly staggered so that a bandwagon effect might be created in favor of approval. This made the later gatherings scenes of high drama as the tally of ratifying states approached the magic number 9. Though the Federalist was originally intended to sway delegate selection in New York, it failed in that intent. When the results were tabulated, the outlook looked pretty ghastly for Hamilton and the Federalists. They had attained a mere 19 delegates in New York City and environs versus 46 for an upstate anti-Federalist slate headed by Governor Clinton. For all the intellectual firepower marshaled in the Federalist, New York had a highly intelligent, well-oiled opposition to the Constitution. By late May, Maryland and South Carolina had given their blessings to the Constitution, bringing the total of ratifying states to 8, just one shy of the number needed, but victory in some of the remaining states seemed questionable. North Carolina and Rhode Island both scorned the scheme, while New Hampshire vacillated. So the battle for the Constitution seemed to boil down to the contests in Virginia and New York, whose conventions began in June. Fortunately for supporters, the second volume of The Federalist was published on May 28th and contained the 8 new essays by Hamilton. These bonus essays appeared in the newspapers between June 14th and August 16th, with a new one cropping up every few days as the New York delegates began to deliberate. Hamilton and Madison vowed to stay in touch as their respective conventions progressed. Because Virginia's started 2 weeks earlier, Hamilton had instructed Madison to relay to him immediately any favorable news, since passage in Virginia might prod reluctant New Yorkers to follow suit. "It will be of vast importance that an exact communication should be kept up between us at that period," Hamilton told Madison. "And the moment any decisive question is taken, if favorable, I request you to dispatch and express to me with pointed orders to make all possible diligence by changing horses, etc." In the same anxious tone, Hamilton arranged for swift riders to race from New Hampshire to New York with any encouraging news. In both cases, Hamilton promised to defray the expenses. For all the high-toned language of the Federalist, Hamilton knew that the New York convention would come down to bare-knuckled politics. A prominent anti-Federalist had already warned him that rather than to adopt the Constitution, I would risk a government of Jew, Turk, or infidel. Hamilton knew that such zealotry would not be amenable to persuasion, especially with George Clinton at the delegation's head. "As Clinton is truly the leader of his party and inflexibly obstinate, I count little on overcoming opposition by reason," Hamilton confided to Madison. "Our only chances will be the previous ratification by 9 states, which may shake the firmness of his followers." Though 8 states had already ratified, the final leg of the journey was anything but smooth. "The plot thickens fast," George Washington told the Marquis de Lafayette in late May. "A few short weeks will determine the political fate of America." As Hamilton gloomily surveyed the scene, he feared that New York might stall for another year before deciding whether to join the Union, and he reiterated to Madison his perpetual fears of an eventual disunion and civil war. Unlike upstate farmers, New York City merchants heartily supported the Constitution and gave a festive send-off to Federalist delegates when they departed for the Poughkeepsie Convention on June 14th. Crowds waved and 13 cannon roared at the Battery as a delegation led by Mayor James DeWayne embarked on a Hudson River sloop for the 75-mile journey upriver. This illustrious group included Hamilton, Jay, and Robert R. Livingston, and it made up in intelligence what it lacked in numbers. As the one person in Poughkeepsie who had signed the Constitution, Hamilton was to enjoy special prestige, but he knew it would be a tough, protracted struggle against George Clinton's fearsome political machine. The convention was held at the Poughkeepsie Courthouse, a 2-story building with a cupola and gruesome dungeons below for prisoners. Governor Clinton was elected as the chairman. If dignified in mien, he was scarcely a neutral arbiter. In Federalist No. 77, Hamilton had already blasted him for running a despicable and dangerous system of personal influence. Clinton feared that Hamilton wanted to obliterate the states, but he was confident he had sufficient votes to squash the Constitution in New York or encumber it with so many conditions as to make its acceptance impossible. At the outset, Hamilton slipped a technical provision into the convention rules that was a tactical bonanza for the Federalists. The Constitution had to be debated clause by clause before a general vote could be taken. It was a masterly stroke. Nobody could vie with Hamilton in close textual analysis, and this step-by-step approach would stall the proceedings, increasing the likelihood that riders from Virginia or New Hampshire would rush in with news that their states had ratified and force New York to follow suit. Governor Clinton gathered several able anti-Federalist speakers, of whom the most adroit was Melancton Smith, who had a dry, plain-spoken manner and an understated wit. He was a deceptively good debater who knew how to lure opponents into logical traps from which they found it hard to escape. Smith saw Hamilton as the cat's paw of an aristocratic clique and told the assembly that he thanked his God that he was a plebeian. He had tremendous respect for Hamilton's abilities, however, even if he found him wordy and discursive. "Hamilton is the champion," he admitted to a friend. "He speaks frequently, very long, and very vehemently. He has, like Publius, much to say not very applicable to the subject." Hamilton's performance at the convention was an exhilarating blend of stamina, passion, and oratorical pyrotechnics. It was a lonely battle. "Our adversaries greatly outnumber us," he told Madison upon arriving. Yet he showed unflagging courage as he stared down a large audience of hostile faces. He spoke 26 times, far more than any other Federalist, and soldiered on for 6 exhausting weeks. He must have operated on severely depleted reserves of energy. Since late October 1787, he had written 51 Federalist essays while juggling the considerable demands of his law practice. Hamilton was implacable in his resolve to win against long odds. When a friend asked him what message he should convey to New York supporters, Hamilton retorted, "Tell them the convention shall never rise until the Constitution is adopted." For spectators jammed into the courthouse galleries, Hamilton made an indelible impression. James Kent attended every session, later telling Eliza that her husband had been prompt, ardent, energetic, and overflowing with an exuberance of argument and illustration. He generally spoke with much animation and energy, and with considerable gesture. His mind was filled with all the learning and precedents required for the occasion, enabling him to make numerous extemporaneous speeches. He seduced the listeners with hope and provoked them with fear, leading one spectator to comment that Hamilton's harangues combined the poignancy of vinegar with the smoothness of oil. During the first days at Poughkeepsie, Hamilton was constantly on his feet, reaching for high-flown eloquence. He denied that Federalists exaggerated the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation. "No, I believe these weaknesses to be real and pregnant with destruction. Yet, however weak our country may be, I hope we shall never sacrifice our liberties." He then cleverly disarmed opponents. "If, therefore, on a full and candid discussion, the proposed system, the Constitution, shall appear to have that tendency, for God's sake, let us reject that." On June 20th, Hamilton made his first prolonged assault on opponents. Not relying on reason alone, he demonstrated how necessary it was for New York's security that it join the new Union. "Your capital is accessible by land and by sea, is exposed to every daring invader. And on the Northwest, you are open to the inroads of a powerful foreign nation." Under the new central government, he insisted, the tax burden would be shared much more evenly than before. He also reassured New Yorkers that state power would keep federal power in check. Hamilton spoke himself into a state of exhaustion and suddenly cut short his speech. "Many other observations might be made on this subject," he apologized, "but I cannot now pursue them, for I feel myself not a little exhausted. I beg leave, therefore, to waive for the present the further discussion of this question." The next day, Hamilton, buoyed by a second wind, disputed that the proposed House of Representatives, with 65 members, would have too few delegates and would be dominated by the rich. In his view, representative bodies did not need to mirror exactly those they represented. Men of substance, wisdom, and experience could care for the common good. If they came more often from the wealthier, better educated portion of the community, so be it. Hamilton did not think the rich were paragons of virtue. They had as many vices as the poor, he noted, except that their vices are probably more favorable to the prosperity of the state than those of the indigent, and partake less of moral depravity. As creditors, they would acquire a special stake in perpetuating the new government, and their power would always be circumscribed by popular opinion. In the general course of things, the popular views and even prejudices will direct the action of the rulers. That same day, Governor Clinton argued that the United States covered so vast a territory and possessed such a variety of peoples that no general free government can suit all the states. In rebuttal, Hamilton outlined his vision of American nationalism, showing that a true nation with a unified culture had been fused from the diverse groups and regions of the original colonies. "In all essential matters, from New Hampshire to Georgia, the people of America are as uniform in their interests and manners as those of any established in Europe." A national interest and a national culture now existed beyond state concerns. This was an assertion pregnant with significance, for if Americans already constituted a new political culture, they needed a new order to certify that reality. And the Constitution bodied forth that order. For anti-Federalists who had traded whispered stories of Hamilton's infamous speech at the Constitutional Convention, He now sounded too reasonable, too plausible, as he spoke of the power of popular opinion. Clearly he must be a brazen manipulator, a two-faced hypocrite, not someone making legitimate concessions for the sake of political compromise. You would be surprised, did you not know the man, what an amazing Republican Hamilton wishes to make himself be considered, Charles Tillinghast told another anti-federalist caustically. But he is known. The conviction that Hamilton must be dissembling became commonplace among his foes, who were bent upon unmasking the perfidious monarchist. The proposed Senate was especially loathsome to Clintonians, who feared it would be an aristocratic conclave. They introduced an amendment allowing state legislatures to recall their senators. This idea touched a live wire in Hamilton, who saw the Senate as a check on fickle popular will and in need of political insulation. The proposal prompted him to make a speech on the dangers of maintaining a continuous revolutionary mentality in America. Hamilton believed that revolutions ended in tyranny because they glorified revolution as a permanent state of mind. A spirit of compromise and a concern with order were needed to balance the quest for liberty. In the commencement of a revolution, which received its birth from the usurpations of tyranny, nothing was more natural than that the public mind should be influenced by an extreme spirit of jealousy. The zeal for liberty became predominant and excessive. In forming our confederation, this passion alone seemed to actuate us, and we appear to have had no other view than to secure ourselves from despotism. The object certainly was a valuable one and deserved our utmost attention. But, sir, there is another object, equally important, and which our enthusiasm rendered us little capable of regarding. I mean a principle of strength and stability in the organization of our government and vigor in its operations. More than anyone else, Hamilton engineered the transition to a post-war political culture that valued sound and efficient government as the most reliable custodian of liberty. Calling such an effort an object of all others the nearest and most dear to my own heart, he said that its attainment was the most important study which can interest mankind. On the same day Hamilton said this, word arrived in Poughkeepsie that New Hampshire had become the 9th state to ratify the Constitution, meaning it would now be activated. This jolted the convention and abruptly transformed the debate from one about constitutional principles to the political expediency of New York's joining the Union. The state now risked political estrangement if it stayed aloof. Nevertheless, the Clintonians continued to load crippling conditions on the Constitution, and Hamilton saw they would yield only if Virginia ratified. We eagerly wait for further intelligence from you, he wrote urgently to Madison on June 27th, as our only chance of success depends on you. The next morning, all the pent-up emotions in Poughkeepsie gave way to rage. It grated on Hamilton that the Clintonians would enter the new Union only under duress, while it galled the Clintonians that the national tide was now running against them. Hamilton made a superb speech about the powers that would be reserved to the states under the Constitution, showing, for instance, how the federal government could not make laws affecting the punishment of certain crimes, such as murder and theft. This was too much for John Lansing, Jr., Hamilton's fellow delegate at the Constitutional Convention, who accused him of saying one thing in Philadelphia and another in Poughkeepsie. In particular, he charged that Hamilton had argued earlier for abolishing the very states that he now held up as necessary foils to federal power. This accusation produced a vivid confrontation. New York's entire delegation from the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton, Lansing, and Yates, dropped all show of decorum and began to denounce each other heatedly. The Daily Advertiser reported that Hamilton described Mr. Lansing's insinuation as improper, unbecoming, and uncandid. Mr. Lansing rose and, with much spirit, resented the imputation. He made an appeal to Judge Yates, who had taken notes in the Federal Convention, for a proof of Mr. Hamilton's expressions. Hamilton must have been flabbergasted. Lansing was inviting Yates to breach the solemn oath of silence taken at Philadelphia. On cue, Robert Yates flashed his notes and quoted Hamilton as having stated in Philadelphia that to stop the states from encroaching on the federal government, they should be reduced to a smaller scale and be invested with only corporate power. At this point, Hamilton turned furiously on Yates and cross-examined him in prosecutorial style. He asked point blank, did Yates not remember Hamilton saying that the states were useful and necessary? Did he not remember him saying that the chief judges of the states ought to join with the chief justice of the Supreme Court in a court of impeachments? Yates assented reluctantly. Governor Clinton, realizing that he had to stop the quarreling, adjourned the session. All of New York gossiped about the highly personalized altercation. One member of Judge Yates's family reported that both Lansing and Hamilton got extremely warm, insomuch that Lansing was charged by the other with want of candor and indecency. Still another observer noted that bickering between Lansing and Hamilton had shaded over from spirited repartee to such personal insults that a duel might follow. Personal reflections were thrown out by Mr. Lansing against Mr. Hamilton, which were productive of serious disputation. It will be well if it does not terminate seriously. 2 days later, the convention still seethed about the matter. As Hamilton tangled with Lansing, neither knew that Virginia had, on June 25th, become the 10th state to ratify the Constitution. Like their New York counterparts, anti-federalists there posed as plucky populists, even though their ranks included many rich slaveholders. Patrick Henry, the leading anti-federalist, warned delegates who supported the Constitution, "They'll free your niggers." George Washington noted the hypocrisy of the many slaveholding anti-federalists. "It is a little strange that the men of large property in the South should be more afraid that the Constitution will produce an aristocracy or a monarchy than the genuine democratical people of the East." Shortly after noon on July 2nd, a rider rode up to the Poughkeepsie Courthouse and handed the doorkeeper a dispatch for Hamilton. Soon an excited murmur arose that drowned out the voice of George Clinton. Hamilton read aloud a letter from Madison with the dramatic announcement of Virginia's approval. It must have been a deeply moving moment for Hamilton, the climax of his partnership with Madison. Joyous Federalists spilled out of the building and circled the courthouse in celebration, accompanied by a fife and drum. If New York did not ratify the Constitution, it would now be stranded and excluded from the newly formed Union, lumped together with the outcast states of North Carolina and Rhode Island. But the sparring now only intensified. At a 4th of July parade in Albany, a riot broke out when a copy of the Constitution was publicly burned and Federalist and Anti-Federalist contingents collided, leaving one dead and 18 wounded. Suddenly on the defensive, Clinton's forces tried to defeat the Constitution by demanding a Bill of Rights and other amendments. Hamilton thought this a tactical maneuver, and on July 12th he spoke at length in favor of unconditional adoption. In what one newspaper called a most argumentative and impassioned address, Hamilton insisted that the convention lacked authority to make recommendations and gravely intoned that the delegates should weigh well what they were about to do before they decided on a subject so infinitely important. Thus, in mid-July, the two sides remained unalterably apart. The point is worth stressing, since some historians have minimized Hamilton's bravura performance at Poughkeepsie by claiming that only approval by Virginia and New Hampshire tipped the scales in New York. Emotions, however, remained venomous even after 10 states ratified the Constitution, and Governor Clinton still thought civil war possible. One member of the French diplomatic legation, Victor Dupont, wrote to Samuel Dupont de Nemours that if the Constitution faltered in New York, outraged Federalists might pounce on Clinton and his retinue when they returned home and smear them with tar, roll them in feathers, and finally walk them through the streets. On July 17th, Hamilton predicted that New York City might secede from the state if the Constitution was turned down. Clinton chided him from his chair for his highly indiscreet and improper warning. Working himself up into a grand state of pathos, Hamilton summoned the ghosts of departed patriots and living heroes and, with his words, wrung tears from onlookers. Days later, Melancton Smith finally broke the deadlock when he endorsed the Constitution if Congress would promise to consider some amendments. Paying indirect tribute to Hamilton, Smith credited the reasonings of gentlemen on the other side for his changed vote. On July 26th, Smith and a dozen other anti-federalists switched their votes to favor the Constitution, producing a wafer-thin majority. The final vote of 30 to 27 was the smallest victory margin at any state convention and portended future political troubles for Hamilton. Governor Clinton would not budge, but tolerated followers who changed their votes. Anticipating New York's approval, a huge rally had taken place in New York City 3 days earlier to express boisterous enthusiasm for the new government. It started at 8 in the morning in light rain as 5,000 representatives of 60 trades, from wig makers to bricklayers, florists to cabinet makers, marched down Broadway amid a profusion of brightly colored floats and banners. The Constitution might be denounced as a rich man's plot upstate, but the city's artisans were now stout-hearted Federalists and crafted displays to illustrate the benefits that would flow from union. The bakers hoisted aloft a 10-foot federal loaf, brewers pulled a 300-gallon cask of ale, and coopers hauled barrels built with 13 staves. Many of Hamilton's friends joined the crowd. Robert Troup marched alongside lawyers and judges, brandishing the new Constitution. Nicholas Kruger, his old employer from St. Croix, donned a farmer's costume and escorted a plow drawn by 6 oxen. The parade apotheosized the hero of the hour, the man who had snatched victory from the anti-federalist majority. So exuberant was the lionization of Alexander Hamilton that admirers wanted to rechristen the city Hamiltoniana. It was one of the few times in his life that Hamilton basked in the warmth of public adulation. Sailmakers waved a flag depicting a laurel-wreathed Hamilton bearing the Constitution, while an allegorical figure representing fame blew a trumpet in the air. This paled before the grandest tribute of all to Hamilton. Gliding down Broadway, pulled by 10 horses, was a miniature frigate, 27 feet long, baptized the Federal Ship Hamilton. The model ship rose above all other floats with flowing sheets and full sails, the canvas waves dashing against her sides and concealing the carriage wheels moving the ship, noted one observer. The cartmen fluttered banners that proclaimed, "Behold the Federal Ship of Fame, the Hamilton, we call her name. To every craft she gives employ, sure cartmen have their share of joy." When the Hamilton arrived near the Battery, it was received by congressmen standing outside Bayard's Tavern. To represent the transition from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, the ship changed pilots amid a deafening cannonade. The parade marked the zenith of the Federalist alliance with city artisans. Hamilton had never courted the masses, and never again was he to enjoy their favor to this extent. Riding high on the crest of the new Constitution, Hamilton and the Federalists held undisputed sway in the city. Chapter 14. Putting the Machine in Motion. The battle royal over the Constitution exposed such glaring rifts in the country that America needed a first president of unimpeachable integrity who would embody the rich promise of the new republic. It had to be somebody of godlike stature who would seem to levitate above partisan politics, a symbol of national unity as well as a functioning chief executive. Everybody knew that George Washington alone could manage the paradoxical feat of being a politician above politics. Many people had agreed reluctantly to the new Constitution only because they assumed that Washington would lead the first government. Within weeks of the Poughkeepsie Convention, Hamilton began to woo Washington for the presidency as determinedly as would a lover. Long ago, he had hitched his career to the generals, and he needed George Washington as president no less than America did. They had shared the same chagrin over the inept Congress and grasping state politicians, and saw an assertive central government as the indispensable corrective. In mid-August 1788, Hamilton broached the subject of the presidency when he sent Washington the 2-volume set of the Federalist Papers. He no longer had compunctions about revealing his authorship with Madison and Jay. This was throat-clearing for the letter's real intent. "I take it for granted, sir, you have concluded to comply with what will no doubt be the general call of your country in relation to the new government. You will permit me to say that it is indispensable you should lend yourself to its first operations. It is to little purpose to have introduced a system if the weightiest influence is not given to its firm establishment in the outset. Washington replied that he had seen no better gloss on the Constitution than the Federalist, and predicted that when the transient circumstances and fugitive performance which attended this crisis shall have disappeared, that work will merit the notice of posterity. This tribute previewed things to come, since the first president would need constitutional experts in his cabinet to advise him on what actions were permissible. Washington approached the presidency gingerly. In the late 18th century, politicians tended to disclaim ambition and pretend that public service was purely sacrificial. So Washington closed the letter with a delicate statement that he would defer a decision on the presidency, intimating that he would rather stay at Mount Vernon. "But you know me well enough, my good sir, to be persuaded that I am not guilty of affectation when I tell you it is my great and sole desire to live and die in peace and retirement on my own farm." Not since the Revolution had Washington and Hamilton spoken so candidly. Their bond, if sorely tested, had never frayed, and Washington seemed relieved to unburden himself about his future. Hamilton knew that the new republic would be on trial in the first administration, and he dreaded having a mediocrity at the top. If the first government miscarried, he warned Washington, the blame will in all probability be laid on the system itself, and the framers of it will have to encounter the disrepute of having brought about a revolution in government without substituting anything that was worthy of the effort. They pulled down one utopia, it will be said, to build up another. Far from bristling, Washington thanked Hamilton for his openness, which enabled him to assess the presidency without betraying unseemly ambition. In a confessional mode, Washington said that at the thought of being president, he always felt a kind of gloom settle upon his mind, and noted that if he became president, the acceptance would be attended with more diffidence and reluctance than ever I experienced before in my life. Sensing Washington's need for gentle prodding, Hamilton stressed that America's glorious destiny demanded him as president, and that no other man can sufficiently unite the public opinion or can give the requisite weight to the office in the commencement of the government. Hearing this from others as well, Washington finally overcame his misgivings and agreed to stand for president. While Hamilton endeared himself to Washington in this first election, he also antagonized John Adams, a man with an encyclopedic memory for slights. Returning from Europe in June 1788, Adams decided that any post less than vice president was beneath himself, as wife Abigail phrased it. As a favorite son of the New England states, with their hefty block of votes, Adams agreed to run for vice president. This created a ticklish predicament. Under the Constitution, the presidential electors cast two votes apiece, but they did not vote separately for president and vice president. Whoever garnered the most electoral votes became president and the runner-up vice president. The peril was manifest. There could be a tie vote, forcing the contest into the House of Representatives. Still worse, a vice presidential candidate might accidentally walk off with the presidency. Everybody is aware of that defect in the Constitution, which renders it possible the man intended for vice president may, in fact, turn up president, Hamilton told Pennsylvania Federalist James Wilson in early 1789. If Adams received a unanimous vote and a few votes were insidiously withheld from Washington, Hamilton said, Adams might edge out Washington for the presidency. Hamilton doubted that the sometimes irascible Adams could unite a divided country or give the new government its best chance of success. For Hamilton, the whole American experiment hinged upon having Washington as president. His worries were only compounded by the improbable presidential candidacy of George Clinton. As Hamilton maneuvered to wean electors away from Clinton, he feared they might turn to Adams instead of Washington. If so, Hamilton brooded, he might inadvertently help to defeat the one man he so desperately wanted as president. In the fall of 1788, Hamilton and Adams had no personal relationship. Hamilton had become a major domestic figure during Adams's long diplomatic sojourn abroad. Adams knew of Hamilton's superlative reputation as a lawyer, but he would naturally have considered the younger man an upstart, a latecomer to the American Revolution. Hamilton, for his part, already felt ambivalent toward Adams. He could recall vividly the sympathy of the Massachusetts Adamses and the Virginia Lees with the nebulous Conway cabal, which had encouraged the military pretensions of General Horatio Gates to supplant Washington. Hamilton told one Massachusetts ally, "The Lees and Adamses have been in the habit of uniting, and hence may spring up a cabal very embarrassing to the executive, and of course to the administration of the government." At the same time, Hamilton credited Adams's indisputable patriotism, his sound understanding, and his ardent love for the public good, and he was certain he would not disturb the harmony of a Washington administration. Hamilton confided to Madison that Adams was a trustworthy friend of the Constitution, and as vice president would provide geographic balance with a Virginia president. Nonetheless, Hamilton fretted that whether by chance or design, Adams might sneak past Washington in the voting. So he approached two electors in Connecticut, two in New Jersey, and three or four in Pennsylvania, and asked them to deny their votes to Adams to ensure that Washington became president. As usual, Hamilton proved excessively fearful. When the 69 electors met on February 4, 1789, they voted unanimously for Washington, who became the first president, and cast only 34 ballots for Adams, who came in second and thus became vice president. The remaining 35 votes were split among 10 candidates. This relatively weak showing dealt a blow to the vanity of John Adams, who bemoaned it as a stain upon his character and even thought of declining the office out of wounded pride. At this juncture, he did not know of Hamilton's efforts to deny him a handful of votes. When he learned of a dark and dirty intrigue, apparently originating in New York, to deprive him of votes, he was incensed. "Is not my election to this office, in the scurvy manner in which it was done, a curse rather than a blessing?" he protested to Benjamin Rush. Adams came to view Hamilton's actions as unforgivably duplicitous. In fact, Hamilton had approached only 7 or 8 electors, so that his actions could have accounted for just a small fraction of Adams's 35-vote deficit. And Hamilton had been motivated by a laudable desire to help Washington, not to harm Adams, whom he favored for vice president. Hamilton was thunderstruck when he learned that Adams had misread his actions as a calculated effort to humiliate him and lessen his public stature. Years later, he portrayed the episode as proof of Adams's extreme egotism and vanity. "Great was my astonishment, and equally great my regret, when afterwards I learned that Mr. Adams had complained of unfair treatment in not having been permitted to take an equal chance with General Washington." It was the first of many hurtful misunderstandings between these two giants of the early republic. The true target of Hamilton's venom was Governor George Clinton, who had been in office for 12 years and ran again in the spring of 1789. Clinton had advocated the rotation of presidents in office, but had no misgivings about converting the New York governorship into his personal fiefdom. Hamilton feared that Clinton would try to undermine the new government. Having waged a vigorous campaign to deny him the presidency, Hamilton now attempted to oust him as governor. Massachusetts Federalist Samuel Otis informed a friend that Hamilton and Philip Schuyler planned to do everything in their power to kill the governor politically. On February 11, 1789, Hamilton chaired an overflowing meeting at Barden's Tavern on Broad Street, a business haunt, to anoint a candidate to challenge Clinton. The hundreds who showed up opted for a surprise choice: Judge Robert Yates. It was dramatic proof of Hamilton's resolve to unseat Clinton that he endorsed this erstwhile foe, whom he thought capable of assembling a winning coalition of downstate Federalists and upstate anti-Federalist farmers. Yates had impressed him by his unswerving support for the Constitution once it was ratified in New York. Hamilton agreed to chair a correspondence committee to foster support for him. One of Yates's dearest friends, the anti-Federalist Aaron Burr, showed up at Barden's Tavern and consented to join the group. Once Hamilton had latched on to Yates, he was determined to strike hard at Clinton in the slashing style that was fast becoming his trademark, a combativeness that may have well been a legacy of his troubled upbringing. He advised one supporter, "In politics as in war, the first blow is half the battle." In customary fashion, Hamilton opened his campaign with a blistering series of 16 anonymous letters printed in the Daily Advertiser under the initials H.G. Like his Federalist essays, Hamilton wrote these letters in a titanic burst of energy, 8 of them appearing in consecutive issues at the end of February 1789 alone. Starting with the first H.G. essay, Hamilton flung poison darts at Clinton. Reviewing the governor's political and military career, Hamilton accused him of narrow views, a prejudiced and contracted disposition, a passionate and interested temper. He questioned Clinton's bravery as a brigadier general during the Revolution. "After diligent inquiry, I have not been able to learn that he was ever more than once in actual combat." In one letter, Hamilton differentiated between two types drawn to revolutions: those sincerely interested in the public good and restless and turbulent spirits, such as Clinton, who sought to exploit unrest to become despots. Upping the stakes, Hamilton accused Clinton of having stolen from Philip Schuyler the first governor's race, which was held during the Revolution, by forcing militia under his command to vote for him. In later H.G. letters, Hamilton occupied higher moral ground. He analyzed Clinton's unremitting opposition to the Constitution and found it unpardonable that the governor had maintained a course replete with danger to the peace and welfare of this state and of the Union. Hamilton wanted New York to continue as the nation's capital, as it had been since January 1785. He noted that Clinton had opposed it as the residence for Congress because he was afraid this would encourage dissolute behavior. "Every man of sense knows that the residence of Congress among us has been a considerable source of wealth to the state, and as to the idle tale of its promoting luxury and dissipation, I believe there has not been for a number of years past a period of greater frugality than that in which Congress have resided in this city." More than just petty, power-hungry, and stubborn, Clinton was cast by Hamilton as a bore devoid of good manners who had not even paid courtesy calls on the last two presidents of the Confederation Congress. The Federalists were overjoyed by these resounding blasts. "Never was anything read with more avidity and with greater success," wrote one Hamilton supporter. Said another, "Colonel Hamilton has taken a very active part in favor of Judge Yates, from which circumstance much is expected. I believe old Clinton, the sinner, will get ousted." The old sinner did not rebut Hamilton with his own quill, preferring surrogates, and rejoinders soon glutted the press. In early March, one Philopas protested the torrent of scurrility from H.G.'s pen, which would make an inhabitant of Billingsgate blush. Another writer said the real issue in the election was that an obscure plebeian, Clinton, had dared to oppose the boundless ambition of patrician families, the Schuylers. If Yates beat Clinton, he predicted, he would be thrust aside at the next election so that the father and the son could divide the fishes and loaves, a transparent reference to Philip Schuyler and his son-in-law Hamilton. By making cutting personal remarks about Clinton, Hamilton had ensured that the retaliation would also be highly personal. That Hamilton could be so sensitive to criticisms of himself and so insensitive to the effect his words had on others was a central mystery of his psyche. The invective grew uglier in late March when someone writing under William Tell branded Hamilton a Machiavellian and tarred him as a power-mad politician puffed up by an expecting band of sycophants, a train of ambitious relations, and a few rich men. William Tell then leveled a charge against Hamilton more terrible than mere ambition. "Your private character is still worse than your public one, and it will yet be exposed by your own works, for you will not be bound by the most solemn of all obligations." 7 asterisks. The 7 asterisks must have signified the word wedlock, meaning that Hamilton was being charged, for the first time in print, with adultery. As we shall see, there was a reason why this charge surfaced at this time. End of cassette 8. Like other founding fathers, Hamilton inhabited two diametrically opposed worlds. There was the Olympian sphere of constitutional debate and dignified discourse, the way many prefer to remember these stately figures, and the gutter world of personal sniping, furtive machinations, and tabloid-style press attacks. The contentious culture of these early years was both the apex and nadir of American political expression. Such a contradictory environment was probably an inescapable part of the transition from the lofty idealism of revolution to the gritty realities of quotidian politics. The heroes of 1776 and 1787 were bound to seem smaller and more hypocritical as they jockeyed for personal power and advantage in the new government. For the remainder of the gubernatorial campaign, Hamilton issued open letters to the electorate, and at Clinton campaign rallies, his essays were hurled under the table as marks of contempt. In shaping his final appeal to voters, Hamilton said that Clinton's most effective tactic was to single out the rich for abuse, and he warned that Republicans scapegoated the rich to their detriment. There is no stronger sign of combinations unfriendly to the general good than when the partisans of those in power raise an indiscriminate cry against men of property. The argument did not persuade voters. Governor Clinton solidly defeated Judge Yates. This vicious election left a trail of wounded feelings, removing any chance of a rapprochement between Hamilton and Clinton. New York remained a bitterly divided state, ripe for political manipulation. The wily Clinton knew that he had to shore up his base, so in September he offered the state attorney general job to Aaron Burr, whom he neither liked nor trusted. For the first time, Hamilton felt betrayed by Burr, who had campaigned for Yates. The political genius of Aaron Burr was to lie in figuring out endless ways to profit from the partisan wrangling in his home state. For 3 years, he had engaged in little political activity. Now, his dormant ambition was beginning to awaken. The new government was launched with all due pageantry and fanfare. On April 16, 1789, George Washington departed from Mount Vernon on an 8-day journey to New York that blossomed into a national celebration. Cannon saluted the president-elect as he approached each town. He passed under many triumphal arches and crossed a bridge in Trenton covered with flower petals strewn by 13 young maidens cooing greetings. If this sometimes seemed like a royal procession, appearances could be misleading. Washington had fallen into debt and had to borrow heavily at exorbitant interest rates to make the trip. When he reached Elizabethtown, New Jersey, he boarded a sumptuous barge that transported him across the Hudson River to New York City. Shaded by a red canopy and tossed by brisk breezes, the barge was towed by 13 pilots. At the foot of Wall Street, Governor Clinton and Mayor DeWayne welcomed the president-elect before masses of cheering people. Church bells chimed, ships in the harbor ran up their colors, and cannon fired a 13-gun salute before Washington made his way to his new residence, a 3-story brick building at 10 Cherry Street. That night, with candles aglow in windows across the city, Governor Clinton hosted a state dinner for Washington. Hamilton smarted over the deference shown to the governor, but Washington wished to convey that he would be the leader of all the people. Selected as temporary home of the new federal government, New York had devoted considerable expense to preparations. Hoping to become the permanent capital, the city had invested in some necessary improvements. The Common Council hired Major Pierre Charles L'Enfant, the French architect and engineer who was to later design Washington, D.C., to renovate City Hall at the corner of Broad and Wall. He transformed it into the elegant, neoclassical Federal Hall, surmounted by a glass cupola. Some money for the alterations came from local citizens and some from Hamilton's Bank of New York. When the new Congress first met there in early April, the flag from the Federal ship Hamilton waved over the building, which had a depiction of an American eagle embedded in its facade. On April 30th, George Washington rose early, sprinkled powder on his hair, and prepared for his great day. At noon, accompanied by a legislative escort, he rode to Federal Hall in a fancy yellow carriage to take the oath of office. 10,000 ecstatic New Yorkers squeezed into the surrounding streets to observe the historic moment. Hamilton, who had done as much as anyone to bring it about, looked on distantly from the balcony of his Wall Street home. From the outset, the 57-year-old Washington was determined to strike a happy medium between regal dignity and Republican austerity. Resplendent with a ceremonial sword at his side, he also wore a plain brown suit of American broadcloth woven at a mill in Hartford. A special message for Hamilton's future was encoded in this outfit, that America should encourage manufacturers, especially textiles, an industry dominated by Great Britain. Washington hoped it would soon be unfashionable for a gentleman to appear in any dress that was not of American origin. The strapping Virginian took the oath on the second-story balcony, flanked by columns against a backdrop of gold stars on a blue background. With John Adams standing beside him, Washington was sworn in by Chancellor Robert R. Livingston and then kissed the Bible brought on a crimson cushion. The moment was joyous, but not flawless. When Washington read a brief inaugural address, probably drafted by James Madison, to Congress in the Senate chamber, he kept his left hand in one pocket and turned pages with the other, making an awkward impression. His nervous mumbling was scarcely audible. One observer said wryly of America's hero, Washington was more agitated and embarrassed than ever he was by the leveled cannon or pointed musket. Afterward, the first president and his entourage marched up Broadway to pray at St. Paul's Chapel, near where Hamilton had attended King's College. Both Alexander and Eliza attended the first inaugural ball on May 17th. Eliza was well placed to be a social ornament of the new regime and later looked back fondly on those days. As I was younger than Martha Washington, I mingled more in the gaieties of the day. I was at the inauguration ball, the most brilliant of them all, which was given early in May at the Assembly Rooms on Broadway above Wall Street. It was attended by the President and Vice President, the Cabinet officers, a majority of the members of the Congress, the French and Spanish ministers, and military and civic officers, with their wives and daughters. Mrs. Washington had not yet arrived in New York from Mount Vernon and did not until 3 weeks later. On that occasion, every woman who attended the ball was presented with a fan prepared in Paris, with ivory frame, and when opened, displayed a likeness of Washington in profile. As a close friend of Philip Schuyler and Hamilton, Washington enjoyed a warm rapport with Eliza and danced with her at the inaugural ball. Like Alexander, she was cordial with Washington, but not too familiar, and she noted that even on the dance floor, he never entirely relaxed or stopped being president. Present at many balls with Washington, she later described how he would always choose a partner and walk through the figures correctly, but he never danced. His favorite was the minuet, a graceful dance suited to his dignity and gravity. This tallies with one observer's comment that Washington seldom laughed and that even when encircled by young belles, his countenance never softened nor changed its habitual gravity. Everything about Washington's administration assured heightened importance since he was setting precedents and establishing the tone of government. No sooner was he sworn in than questions of protocol provoked hair-splitting debates. How should a president be addressed? Should he receive visitors? Since many anti-federalists were convinced that Hamilton and his circle meditated a monarchy, they followed such debates avidly for signs of incipient treachery. Though Hamilton opposed noble titles, he wondered what would substitute for courtly forms to inspire reverence for law. Other founders labored under a similar apprehension. In May 1789, Ben Franklin told Benjamin Rush, "We have been guarding against an evil that old states are most liable to, excess of power in the rulers. But our present danger seems to be defect of obedience in the subjects." The new vice president, John Adams, adopted an especially princely style that outraged Republicans and was even mocked by Washington for his ostentatious imitation and mimicry of royalty. The Adamses rented the enchanting mansion known as Richmond Hill, which had splendid Hudson River views and was later home to Aaron Burr. Each morning, John Adams climbed into a costly coach, driven by a liveried servant, then presided over the Senate in a powdered wig. He was often accompanied by his second son, Charles, just down from Harvard. Still unaware that Hamilton had worked to pair his electoral votes, Adams asked in July if Charles could study law with him. Hamilton accepted this flattering request. In May, when a Senate committee took up the explosive issue of titles, Adams suggested that Washington be addressed as His Highness, the President of the United States of America, and Protector of their Liberties. Adams provided fodder for contemporary wags and was promptly dubbed His Rotundity, or the Duke of Braintree. Adams wanted only to inspire respect for the new government, but his concern for decorum bred a belief in suspicious minds that he sought a hereditary monarch, with himself as king and son John Quincy groomed as his dauphin. In a slap at the Senate, the House of Representatives decided that the chief executive was to be referred to simply as George Washington, President of the United States, and the Senate then concurred. In early May, Washington asked Hamilton for his reflections on presidential etiquette. End of Disc 11.